Good evening, everyone. Tonight we're wrestling with faith, number four. But tonight is a real wrestle.
Yeah, sure.
We're going to have a real challenge tonight. It's about suffering. As Chaim Bela mentioned, God gave us three rings. One is called engagement ring. So when you get engaged, you get a ring. Second is called the marriage ring.
And the third is suffering.
So it goes in that order, by the way. Anyways, just a joke. Don't take it so serious. But the point here is, understanding our response, how do we respond to suffering? And what's the right way of responding to suffering? So, just for 1 minute, there is there's four different responses on page 102, the student page, of how do we respond to suffering. When we suffer tragedy, God forbid, tragedy could be illness, a loss of a good one, whatever, you know, there's so many. I mean, I could give you a whole list of tragedies, but everyone knows what tragedies are because everyone went through something in life. You know, life is not, who didn't have tragedy in life? I don't know of anyone. So, unless you know someone, let me know. When we suffer tragedy, we seek to understand its cause and meaning. Is that true or not? When a person suffers a tragedy, do you seek to understand, like, why or what's going on? Like,
yes.
Do you feel that? Do you have that feeling?
Yes.
There was a woman on the news tonight. She lost her house in the fires in California.
Oh, yeah.
First thing she said was, "Where was God?"
Oh, she said that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's one. Number two, struggling with faith in God. Right? Where was God, like you said? Number three, when we suffer tragedy, we are prone to feeling loneliness. We feel like alone. You know, like, let's take an example. Someone, God forbid, has to bury the child, right? Which is the worst you could think of. And you think, like, I'm the only one suffering like this. You know what I'm saying? Like, you feel like almost alone. Like, here I am. My world has stopped. My whole life has changed. And now what do? You know, you feel very lonely. The last thing is, even after you get out of your suffering, there's always a scar. Is that true or not?
Yes.
Could a person go back to a normal life and even better after suffering, or there's always going to be some scar left? I'm asking you as a question. I'm not saying it as a statement.
A lot of it depends on the person.
A lot of it depends on the person. So, God forbid, if someone, God forbid, loses a child, which is a terrible, terrible, terrible tragedy, could they ever come back to life?
Yes.
And live again?
Yes. If they have faith.
They could?
Yes.
How long would it take?
Depends on the person.
Depends on the person?
Today, someone told me about, I know that she lost a child, but she explained to kids in a classroom that the neshama stays. And her faith that the neshama is still there gives her a lot of comfort.
Gosh.
That's why she's happy every day. So this is the belief gives her support and gives her strength and makes her happy.
Okay, what did you say, Rachel?
This lady, I forgot her name, Peretz, Miriam Peretz, that she lost two sons. And her husband died. And all her life is to give for others. But whenever there is another mishpacha shkula in Israel, she just go and help them. And she's just amazing. Whenever I see her, I'm crying because she's just a very inspirational lady. Huh? So some people just take it to
the better way. Place. Yeah. So sometimes the opposite, right? Now, there's a famous, I don't know if anyone watches Fiddle on the Roof, because it's not a Jewish, no. So he has a famous saying there, right? If we're the chosen people,
why
choose us, right? He was, in other words, he was saying to God, can't you choose someone else for a little while?
Yes.
You know, to suffer everything. So, suffering is a very strong issue. But here is a very strange thing. There is people, especially when you're dealing with the Holocaust, people always ask, you know, where was God? You know, all these questions. So, there is a response that the Rebbe wrote to a lady about the Holocaust, that lost, you know, family in the Holocaust. And the Rebbe says, you know, from the way you're responding, you're expressing disappointment in the chaotic chaos of the Holocaust, you know, so that means in your mind you deeply believe that there's supposed to be a certain system that was not lived up to what you think of. So that means the fact that you are saying and upset that the system wasn't the way you thought it's supposed to be means that you believe that there is a certain system run by something. So that means the way you're writing is already expression there's a God. Because if there's no God, then anything can happen. So what's your complaint about the Holocaust? A Meshuggah came and did a Holocaust. Another Meshuggah came, something else. There's no God anyway. The fact that you're upset means that you expected that it shouldn't be like that, because there should be justice and righteousness and a system in this world. So the fact that you're complaining about it means that you assume there should be justice and righteousness because you believe there's a God that, and therefore you're complaining, how did God let it happen? You know what I'm saying? So let's read text 1 in a moment, and then you'll see. This is the, you understand the guy there? Text 1, page 103. Yeah?
I don't believe your assertion that you don't believe in God. In fact, it is clear to me that even you don't believe it. The proof is, you write in your letter that upon perceiving in your world a lack of justice and fairness, and upon recalling the Holocaust caused by Hitler, may his name be erased, you are disturbed. Now, if there were no force conducting and planning world events, why is it surprising when injustice occurs? And the big swallows the small, etc. Note that this question of unfairness is not only regarding world-scale events like the Holocaust, even regarding simple day-to-day occurrences. We are disturbed by any unfair event and expect things to be different. Now, the realms of the inanimate and the animal kingdom surely aren't expected to abide by the rules of justice. Who or what, then, do we expect to act justly? We must conclude that the uneasiness caused by these negative events must be due to an awareness of a force that is beyond the inanimate and animal realms, and even the human realm. The awareness of this force is found in the heart of every person. This is what gives rise to the wide-held conviction that justice ought to rule the world, and that world events ought to be fair. Therefore, when something isn't right, we desperately seek the cause for this unnatural state of events.
Someone once, an interesting story, a grandmother went with a grandson to the beach, you know, to, maybe it was in the summer, swimming. And then all of a sudden a big wave comes and, you know, like, takes the little child right into the ocean. She's screaming, God, I mean, how could you do this to me? This, I was taking a walk with grandchild. It's my loving, only grandchild, and you sweep him away like this. God, please, if you bring him back, I'll, you know, I'll do everything, you know, I'll never eat non-kosher. Anyways, a wave comes and brings the child right back. And he says, God, but he had a hat on. Where's the hat? The reason I'm saying it is we have this assumption that there's a certain order of law that's supposed to work in this world. Like there's a system. And who's that system? It's God. And therefore we say, where's the hat? That means, where's justice? But if there's no God, then what are you saying? Where's justice? There's nothing. So the way you're asking the question about the Holocaust means that you expected that it shouldn't be, because it should be, that why should 6 million Jews be killed if there's a God? So the fact that you have the complaint means that you believe that there's a God that has to have a system that you don't understand. Why would he do such a thing? You know what I'm trying to say? But if you don't believe there's a God, so then there's no system. So whatever happens, it just happened. What could I do? There was a Holocaust, there was a Spanish Inquisition. This is just happenings of crazy people. What do you expect? It's a crazy world. You understand a little what she's saying?
But it's not satisfying to hear that answer.
No, it's not an answer. This is just saying that the fact that you tell me there was no God is not true, because the fact that you're complaining about it means that you believe there's a God that has a system, and therefore you're complaining, so where was God? And why didn't he do the system that I hoped he would do?
You're going to answer that question?
Yeah, exactly. That's what we're going to answer today. What do you think, I'm going here for easy questions? You know, it's funny that you find two opposite people, like we said before, after the Holocaust. You have people that became totally
irreligious,
and some became the opposite. So it's like the lady that you said, the lady that goes around and, hello, the lady that goes around, what's her name, in Israel after she lost her two sons and her... Huh? And she goes comforting everyone else. She lost two sons and a husband. So what, that's also a big Holocaust for them, you know? Okay, so there is a famous doctor, professor, or psychologist, whatever you want to call him, Dr. Howard Kushner. And he has a very interesting approach.
Bad things happen to good people.
No, no, listen to this approach.
But he wrote that book.
Yeah, he wrote the book. It was one of the best-selling books, by the way.
Yes.
So anyways, he feels like this. God is aware of my suffering. We believe as a Jew that there's a God, and God knows we're suffering. Mm-hmm. You know, to say that God doesn't know we're suffering, that's like little children, like, God doesn't know we're suffering. Of course he knows we're suffering. Now the question is, could God help us from our suffering? We know that God knows we're suffering, but could he help us?
Yes.
Or it's helpless?
He helps us.
Can he get us out of the suffering?
Yes.
So why didn't he? That's a good question. We're going to answer that in a minute. 1 second. The third thing is, God has my best interests in mind. Because some people want to say that, you know, God knows we're suffering, but he wants us to suffer. I'm giving you an answer what some people say. So if God knows we're suffering and he wants us to suffer, so he wanted 6 million Jews to get killed because he wanted us to suffer. But we, as Jews, know it's not true. We know that God knows my suffering. Number two, God is capable of getting me out of the suffering. And three, God only wants to do good for us.
This is why
In the Kushner book, he says, God knows our suffering. God has our best interest. You know, God loves us and is kind, but he can't get us out of the suffering. And the way he puts it is, you know, humans, God created the humans, and God created Mother Nature, and it just runs on its own, so to say. So you have Meshuggah and the humans. that act crazy like Hitler. And this is what Hitler did. God never feels bad for you, you know, because God is loving and God is kind and God is compassionate and God is giving and God is merciful. But God can't do anything. This is the human's behavior. It's like you're bringing it on yourself. It's like a parent tells a child, don't cross the street. You're too young. And cross the street and a car hits him. So what are you going to say? What could the parent have done? The parent told him, don't. The parent told him, I love you. And you brought it on yourself. So the Krishna philosophy is that God knows everything. And God is benevolent and great, but he's not capable of controlling Mother Nature and human behavior. Because God created the world in a way that Mother Nature and human behavior, he leaves it in their hands. You get what I'm saying a little? It's like someone said, the fires in California now. You know, there was a fire.
Oh, it's terrible.
It's like burning
it's
thousands of homes. So someone said, it's the people's fault. What do you mean the people's fault? They should have, since there's a drought there, I'm just telling you what people are saying.
Yeah, but you used it in earlier days in the Bible, in some of the stories.
What?
He did use Mother Nature.
But he was able to control it. Here we're talking about, can God stop the fires in California now?
Parting of the Red Sea, I'm sure there's a few stories in the Bible.
So I'm saying, could God stop the fires in California right this second?
If he produced rain, he could.
Wait, are you asking me if he can or if he should?
If he can.
No.
If he can? If he's God, yes. If he should?
No, the Krishna book, the Krishna philosophy is, this book called, published in 1981, when bad things happen to good people.
He lost a child, that's why he wrote the book.
No, so his philosophy is that God can't.
Oh, okay.
His philosophy, not.
Got it.
His philosophy is that God can't control the nature. So in his mind, the fires in California, God knows about it. I'm talking the way he thinks. He's writing his book. God knows about the fires. God feels terrible about all the losses of the home. God is like, loves these people, but there's nothing he can do because it's Mother Nature. That's the philosophy of his. However, that's not the Jewish philosophy. The Jewish philosophy is...
He's a rabbi.
Okay, I'm just saying, but the Torah philosophy, he did it, it helped for, it talks to some people like that. But in Torah, we believe in the three most important things, which is God is aware of everything, which means he knows everything. As the three expressions, if you want to use philosophical words, God is omnipresent. What does omnipresent mean?
Everything.
That means he knows everything. And God is in control of everything. So if he wants to stop the fires in California, he could stop it this second. And God is benevolence. Benevolence means he's just loving and kind. Here the question becomes, God, if you know the fires are happening in California, and you know, and you're beloved, it means you're loving, and you could stop it, so why are you not stopping it? What's going on here? You understand? We're not following Krishna's philosophy.
So what's the answer?
We're going to get to it in a minute. But this is why our question becomes stronger. In Krishna's book, there's nothing God can do with the fires. The reason I'm using the fires is because it's a natural disaster. You know what I'm saying? There's terrorists that you could say, oh, the people chose to be bad. And God doesn't mix into the choice. He lets you choose. So you could say, well, God can't stop a terrorist. We'll get into that soon. But we believe, as Jews, that God is the ultimate good, the ultimate knowledge, he knows everything, and he's in control of everything. So if so, God, how come you're allowing the fires to continue? If you could stop it now. And why did you allow the Holocaust? You understand what I'm trying to bring out? Okay. If you go to the next text too, you'll see that if you're a true believer in God, then you ask questions on God. You know, some people think if you believe in God, it means you're not supposed to ask questions. Just the opposite. We find in the Torah that the ones that really, really believe in God, those are the ones that challenge God and say, God, how dare you do this? Where do we find this? We find this by Abraham, the first Jew, when God said, I want to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. So he says, God, how dare you do this? And he argued with God, who knows how long it took, maybe hours. Maybe this 50 righteous, and then look at the words he uses, text 2, like such strong words.
It would be unthinkable for you to do such a thing, to kill the righteous with the wicked, thereby making the righteous and wicked equal. It is unthinkable for you. Will the judge of the entire world not do what is just?
Clear? Moshe also. What did Moshe do when Moshe was given the mission to take the Jews out of Egypt? So he comes to Paro, he says, Paro, you know God sent me to take the Jews out? So Paro says, who's God? I mean, I never heard of such a thing. He says, well, you never heard of God? Well, I'll make you hear God soon. If you don't send them out, you'll know God very soon. After Moshe came the first time, Paro made it worse for the Jews. He used to provide them with bricks, you know, the mortar for the bricks. And once Moshe came to ask to take the Jews out, he made a decree, no more giving you mortar, you have to now make your own bricks. So the Jews come to Moshe and says, not only are you not helping us, you're making it worse for us. Get out of here, Moshe. Like, don't disturb us here. So Moshe says to God, God, I don't understand you. You begged me 7 days, you're begging me in the burning, by the burning bush, go get the Jews out of Egypt. And since I came, you made it worse? What are you making it worse for the Jewish people? So God says, Moshe, calm down. You're going to see now all the miracles I'm going to do. So you see, Moshe, what does he do? Because he believes in God, he challenges God. So when we see injustice in the world, and you believe in God, don't say, well, if I believe in God, this is what God wants. No, you're supposed to challenge God. And say, God, how dare you make this person ill? What a good person it is. How dare you do this to this fine person? Because we believe in God. The last thing that happens when we suffer is called feeling lonely. You feel like you're the only one suffering the amount of suffering that you're suffering. You know what I'm saying? Like when someone goes through a tragedy, you almost feel that you're the only one that's going through such a... like no one is with you. As it says in text 3, one of the things the Jews always say, yeah?
Haven't these disasters happened to me because my God isn't with me?
That's like a thing. Isn't that the reason why it happened? Because God is not with me? Meaning that God wants me to suffer. And he says, you know, here, let him suffer. I'm just giving him over to the Nazis, let him do what he wants. Maybe that's why God is making me suffer, because he just forsaked me. He says, go, Zagazind, go, get rid of him. Is that true? Now, to answer this question, we're going to answer it with 3 steps. Okay? Step number 1, step number 2, and step number 3. By the time you finish the 3 steps, you'll say, wow, God, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. I'm not suffering. I never suffered in my life. Could you imagine you would say that? Okay, I also can't imagine. Okay, Let's go to text 4, but before we get to text 4, I just want to give you a little explanation. Okay, the burning bush. When Moshe was by the burning bush for 7 days, you have to understand that Moshe was dealing with a whole nation that was enslaved in Egypt and they were suffering. How many years were they there? 200 years. Being beaten, being the, you know, anti-Semitism, everything was wrong with, you know. So God is begging him, begging him, begging him. Finally, after a long 7 day discussion, Moshe says to God, okay, you want me to take the Jews out? I just have a question. What happens if I come to the Jewish people and they ask me, what's your name? You remember that in the Torah or no? Mm-hmm. Yosef, you don't remember that?
No.
I thought you heard it in the Torah reading on Shabbos. No? So you know what so he says, what's your name? Now I want to ask you a question. Why is Moshe asking such a question, what's your name? Doesn't Moshe know God's name? He's speaking to him for 7 days. Who's he talking to? He's talking to God. Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, which was the first Jewish patriarchs, they taught the children that there's a God. So if someone asks you, what's God's name? You say, God. What's the big thing? He asks, what's the name? What should I tell them your name? What's the question? What's God's name? God's name is God. What is the other name that you have for God?
Hashem.
Hashem.
Well, maybe because there were other gods that they believed in.
The Jews?
At the time in Egypt.
Oh, in Egypt. So wait, if he gives them the name, they won't believe in other gods?
No, so maybe that's where the question came up from.
And you know what God answered him? What his name is? You ever heard of such a name? Well, in the seven names of God, that name doesn't exist. I shall be where I shall be. What kind of answer to the seven names? So let's look in text 4, and once you get this answer, you'll say, wow, now I understand why Moshe wanted the name. Yeah?
God said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people who are in Egypt, and I have heard their cries of distress because of their slave drivers, for I am aware of their suffering. I have come down to rescue them from the hands of the Egyptians and to bring them up from the land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen how the Egyptians are oppressing them. Now go, I will send you to Pharaoh, and you will take my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, and that I should take the children of Israel out of Egypt? He replied, for I will be with you, and this will be your sign that I sent you. When you take the people out of Egypt, you will serve God on this mountain. Moses said to God, I will come to the children of Israel, and I will say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they will say to me, what is his name? What shall I respond to them? God said to Moses, Eheyeh asher eheyeh, I will be what I will be. And he said, say the following to the children of Israel, Eheyeh, I will be, has sent me to you.
What kind of answer is that? What? You ever heard of a name, I will be? I never heard someone call God, I will be. People say about themselves, I will be here tomorrow in shul at 7. Or I will be at the Kiddush to make sure to eat at the Kiddush. But they don't call God, I will be. So, who uses that name? You ever heard someone use it today? So the first question is, why would the Jewish people be so interested in knowing God's name? If you're suffering for 200 years and someone comes to you and says, come, I'm taking you out, you just run out. Imagine you're sitting in Siberia for 8 years and a guy comes and says, I'm getting you out, come. So you run, you go out. What are you asking? Whose name? What name of God? What? When? You want to get out of your problem? No. they're going to ask me, what's your name? Why would the Jews want to know what's your name? Number two, did they not know God's name already? The Jews knew God's name from thousands or hundreds of years, from Abraham. And was Moshe ignorant? Moshe couldn't answer it? He didn't know, he had to ask God, what's your name? He could have told the Jews what he calls God. When you ask Moshe, how do you talk to God? What do you say? Moshe would say, the way he talks to God, his name. So what do you mean, why does he have to ask God to tell him what's the name? Doesn't Moshe know the name? You understand the question? And the answer is a very strange answer. Moshe was not asking God what his name is. Everyone knows God is God. What he's asking God is, I don't understand you. The Jews are going to ask me, what name means? Very simple. What happened to you the last 200 years? Where were you? If you're the God that really cares about us, and you want Moshe to take us out because you've been seeing the suffering, so where were you till now? Where were you till now? What did he say to Moshe? I see the Jews suffering, and I want to take them out of the suffering. So Moshe says, so what do I tell them? Where were you till now? If this is the God that's so kind, if this is the God that's so loving and so caring about his chosen people, so where were you till now? What name means? What attribute did you use till now? A name is an attribute, because God has seven names, which is the seven attributes of God: kindness, discipline, mercy, determination, bonding. So what name do I tell them? What kind of God, if it's such a God that cares about the Jewish people, and he represents the name of goodness, of chesed, of kindness, so where was he for the last 200 years? Why did you wake up now? If you look in text 4, what does he say? God says that I have indeed seen the misery of my people who are in Egypt, and I heard the cries of distress because they're slaves, and I'm aware of their suffering. So if you're aware of the suffering, you see them suffering, so where were you till now? You fall asleep? Went on vacation? What name, meaning what attribute and character could I express about this God? The name is an expression of the person. What kind of God do I say it is? A good God? Name is, how do I describe this God? Good? Mean? Benevolent? Merciful? Well, if you're a good God, where were you for 200 years? If you're a mean God, then I don't want you now either. So how do I relate to you? As a good God, a mean God? A happy God, a caring God? A loving God, an angry God? What do I say? Who are you? I know you're a God. But what kind of God are you? What kind of name do I attribute to you? That's what bothered Moshe. So look in text 5. Now you understand? Yeah?
Can I just go back for a question? To me, and this is very probably, I don't know, coming from where I'm coming from, God is intervening with Moshe. Why has he selected to intervene there and not with the Holocaust?
Exactly. That's what Moshe is asking. Moshe's, the difference is that Moshe is asking, why did you wait 200 years? But you'll soon see Moshe was asking, if you're a good God, so why is there any suffering? Exactly. He's going to say it in a minute. Go to text 5.
This was Moses' question. I will come to the children of Israel and I will say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. This will undoubtedly elicit the question, what is his name? The Jews will immediately ask, what kind of name, that is, behavior, is this to allow a terrible exile to endure for so many years, and only after thousands upon thousands of Jewish children have been murdered, that's when we are told that I have heard their cry. I will descend to rescue them. Moses adds and emphasizes that he himself has this question and protest too. What should I tell them?
You know, when Moshe asked God, what's your name? Because Moshe had the same question. It's not a question that the Jews are going to only ask me. I myself am bothered. What kind of God is this? What kind of behavior? God means what kind of name? What kind of behavior are you? Are you a good God? A loving God? So where were you for 200 years? I have the question, and the Jews are going to ask me this question. What do I tell them? So look how God answers. I will be. Where I will be. What does that answer mean? Look. God said.
God said to Moses, I will be what I will be. And he said, say the following to the children of Israel, I will be has sent me to you.
What does that mean? I will be. So if you look in 6b and 7, you'll understand the answer, yeah?
I will be with them in this trouble, that I will be with them in their subjugation by other kingdoms.
Which was the Holocaust. Look in text 7.
This then was the meaning of God's response. I will be what I will be, as understood by Rashi. I will be with them in both this hardship and in future hardships. God hadn't ignored the suffering of the Jewish people in their bitter exile. Heaven forbid. On the contrary, I will be with them in this hardship. God is together with the Jewish people in this hardship. This doesn't only mean that God is found in their presence. Rather, he is found in their pain. As the prophet says, whenever they are in pain, he too is in pain, in Isaiah. When the Jewish people suffer, this, so to speak, causes God to suffer too.
So when God is saying is very, very powerful, he says, listen, you think you have this misunderstanding. You think that the Jews were suffering for 200 years in Egypt. And I was, meanwhile, on vacation on a cruise somewhere. And now I woke up. I said, hey, my people are suffering. Let me get them out. God says, Eye Asher Eye. I will be, and I will be. Meaning, these 200 years that the Jews were suffering, not only was I there in Egypt, but I suffered with their suffering. So when the Egyptian took a whip and whipped the Jew, God suffered the pain that the Jew was suffering. God himself had that pain.
Why did God let it happen?
One second. Wait. But listen to what he's answering here. We have this misconception. Oh, if you're suffering means God forsake you. You know, like God left me alone and he's letting me suffer. He's telling you, no. Anytime someone is suffering, not only is God there, but God is suffering with them in the pain and tragedy. He's suffering their pain more than they are having the pain. That's what he told them. As it says in the Torah, Imam Anochi B'tzara, I am with you in your suffering. It says that in the Torah.
But then he's selective about who he allows to continue to suffer and perish?
No. So now we're going to get to the question. If God is in pain with us, why does God want to go through the pain? In other words, why is he going through the pain? Till now we thought that you suffer, God means God forgot you, and he'll wake up one day and he'll remind himself you're suffering. What God is telling Moshe, I will be and I will be. Meaning, I was in your pain and I will always be in any pain. Any suffering that anyone suffers, I am with you. I will be there. I feel that pain that you're having. I'm going through that same pain exactly the way you're going through it. In any tragedy a person has. I will be in Egypt and I will be. Past, future, and present. In any suffering, I'm in not only in the space of the suffering, I am in the pain itself. As King David said, we say this psalm maybe 100 million times. What is it? It's by funerals, usually say it. What do we say in that psalm? Remember that?
The Song of David. God is my shepherd, I lack nothing. He lays me down in green pastures. He leads me beside peaceful waters. He restores my energy. He guides me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. For I walk in the valley of the shadow of death. I will fear no harm, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me.
So what does he say? That when I'm suffering, with me. So now we get one piece here. What do we get here? That whenever we or anyone suffers, we're not alone. God is suffering the same pain we are suffering, and even more. Now we have the question, so if so, God, why are you suffering? Get out of the suffering. What are you suffering with us? You don't want to be in pain. You're in pain, get out of this. Get us out and get you out. You get what I'm saying? But it's such a comforting thing. Like sometimes a person goes through such tragedy in their life, a divorce, losing a child, losing a parent, whatever it is, illness, a job, everything you can think of. And you feel like, oi, where am I? That oi and that pain, God is feeling that pain with you and pain with you crying. So God, if you're crying with me, why do you want to cry? Why do you want me to cry? Now the question is a different kind of question. Now that you're feeling my pain, you like pain? Why would you want pain and you feel the pain the way we feel it? It's not the pain the way, you know, God feels your pain. He's with you. So here, we're going to show you an interesting thing. We're going to put on a little video of an interesting man. This is, he passed away in 2004 from Chicago. And I don't know if you remember the Chernobyl reactor. There was in Chernobyl, it was a city. The reactor exploded, and it was a nuclear reactor, and a lot of people died. And then they had this mission that Chabad airlifted a lot of children from Chernobyl, called the Chernobyl Children. And they brought them to Israel, and they had to go through recovery and all kinds of, you know, because the nuclear could damage people for life. So this person was involved in this whole thing. So let's read the listen for a minute for the PowerPoint.
Dr. J. Litvin was born in Chicago in 1944. A talented and sensitive soul, his search for fulfillment led him on a wild goose chase through texts and through nature, from the mountaintops of Oregon to the jungles of Mexico and many places in between. To his surprise, his years of searching came to a marvelous conclusion at the age of 37, when he encountered Chabad of Milwaukee and discovered Torah and mitzvah, a rich heritage that spoke to his mind and soul. April 26, 1986 would forever change Jay's life. The Unit 4 reactor of the Chernobyl nuclear power station in Soviet Ukraine exploded, releasing catastrophic amounts of radioactive material. The greatest contamination fell on Chernobyl and its environs, an area densely populated by Jews for centuries, with devastating long-term health effects. In 1993, Jay moved with his family to Israel to serve as the medical liaison for Chabad's Children of Chernobyl program, which airlifted children out of the contaminated region and brought them to specifically designed facilities in Kfar Chabad, Israel, for treatment and resettlement. Jay gave his heart and soul to this rescue effort, visited Chernobyl extensively, and became the face of the compassionate program. Later, when Israel was rocked by relentless terror attacks during the Second Palestinian Intifada, Jay again rose to the fore, establishing and directing Chabad's Terror Victims Project that supplemented medical and social services for Israeli victims. At the same time, personal disaster struck. In the year 2000, Jay began a fierce battle against a cancer that took his life just 4 years later. A master of the pen, Jay wrote extensively, particularly during his years of intense suffering. His 67 articles posted on Chabad.org are deeply personal, revealing joys and struggles, convictions and doubts. They testify to an inspiring example of a beautifully human believer. In the following text, Jay depicts his conviction in God's loving presence within his own painful and terrifying predicament. He entitled it, From Under the Covers. During this time of my illness, I have sought to connect what is happening in my life within the context of my religious observance and my personal relationship with God. From the intensity of my current condition, I find myself in a surprisingly intimate and direct alliance with the Almighty, though in a way I would not have predicted. Beneath it all, there is this quiet awareness of God. There is the foundation of His presence. There is a silent recognition that I can always call home when I need to, and that someone will show up if it's raining too hard and I've forgotten my umbrella. God is not asking me to place Him out there somewhere and talk to Him, pray and meditate on His glory and His kingdom. Instead, during this time, He has come with the incredible opportunity to find Him in every detail of the daily challenge before me. No, God has not left me in the dark. He sits in a chair at my bedside, watching over me. And rather than needing to call out in my moments of fear, I simply need to slip my hand from under the covers to reach out and take His hand in mine, for only the moment it takes to reassure me of His presence. Jay passed on in 2004, but not before penning masterful reminders to all sufferers to come that they are not alone. God stands with them, taking part in their pain and tenderly offering His presence.
Nice. Now, that's text 9. We're not going to read it, but that's exactly what you just saw now, is text 9. However, we remain with the question. If God is with our suffering,
why was suffering,
and God is with us and feels our pain, so why are we suffering? What's going on? So here to answer this question, which is a very interesting, this is, we call it step number 2. It's called Two Sides of the Tapestry. Tapestry is women, there's a lot of women have this, it's like a straight, you know, I'll show you a picture of it, hold on. Is that it? Tapestry?
That's it. Oh. That's it.
You know what it is? It's like a
needle point.
And you
a piece of fabric.
Yes.
You do the needle, and then on one side is where you make the knot.
Yes.
And the top comes out like a picture or something. You know what I'm talking about?
Sure.
Or it's like a flat
it's
thing.
A
then you.
Store in Burlington.
I don't know how they call it. Tapestry.
Tapestry.
Huh?
Needle point.
What do they call it?
Rikma.
In the Torah, Ma'aseh Rokem, yeah. So you have the top of it, right? Mm-hmm. Look how beautiful it is. Wow. See?
That takes forever to do that.
Yeah, it's such a hard one. And then you have the back. See? The top?
Okay.
And look at the back.
It's all knots.
Look at the top. How beautiful it is. So Rabbi Yosef Soloveitchik, he wrote a book called Dodi Dofek, as you can read in text 10. he uses this analogy of this tapestry to understand if God is suffering with us, what's going on here? And I'll end another piece of it, a story, and then we'll get to the step number three of what do we do. But look how he answers the question. Evil.
Evil is a fact that cannot be denied. There is evil in the world. There are suffering and agony and death pangs. He who would deceive himself by ignoring the split in existence and by romanticizing life is but a fool and a fabricator of illusions. It is impossible to conquer monstrous evil with philosophical speculative thought. Certainly the testimony of the Torah regarding creation, that it is good in Genesis, is true. However, this is only stated from the unbounded perspective of the Creator. In man's finite, limited view, the absolute good in creation is not apparent. The contrast is striking and undeniable. To what might the situation be compared? To a person who views a beautiful tapestry, the work of a fine artisan, which contains woven into it on its front a representation dazzling to the eye. To our great sorrow, we see this image that is the world from the adverse side. Can such a sight become a sublime aesthetic experience? Thus we are incapable of comprehending the panorama of reality, without which one cannot uncover God's master plan, the essence of the works of the Holy One.
You understand what he's saying here or no? So from God's perspective, what do you see? That beautiful tree, flowers, the beautiful home. But then we see just knots, because you see the other side. So for us, there's a lot of knots here. There's a lot of nuances and challenges, and you know. And from God, it's like, oh, it's a beautiful tapestry. Wow. So yes, God is with you, and God is up. But from God, He sees this suffering as the most beautiful experience for us, not for Him. He's looking at this knots from the other side. The knots that we are going together with God, you know, the knotting of all these knots that go through our life, another knot, He sees it as a fine, beautiful piece of art that every human is different. There's a famous story, just to give this a little more understanding, of Rabbi Elimelech of Lizinsk. He was lived in Russia, you know, 200 years ago, and he was known for being a very righteous and pious Jew, and many people came to ask him to pray. So one time when he was praying so deeply to God, his teacher and his mentor, that was already passed away many years before, came to him during his prayer and said, "I just want you to know that I can't help you anymore. When you pray, I can't help you anymore. I can't help you that your prayer should be answered. I just can't. I lost that ability." So he says to his master, the Maggid Rishon, "I thought that when a tzaddik soul passes on, he becomes even greater and more powerful. Why can't you help me and help me with my prayers that God should nullify all the terrible suffering that the Jews are suffering and under the Tsar, and under the terrible rulership of the Tsar 200 years ago?" She said, "I'll tell you why. Since my soul left the body, I live in a different reality. And all your suffering that you're talking about, I can't see it as suffering. I see it from the top of the tapestry. So I can't come to God and say, 'God, take away the suffering,' because I don't see the suffering anymore. You continue to pray because for you it's suffering and you ask God to stop. But I don't see it anymore. I see the top part of the knot, not the bottom part, you know, the. So what are we saying here? What are we saying is a very important thing. I think it's two important steps. One is, we're not alone. God doesn't forsake us when we're suffering. On the contrary, God is with us and he's suffering with us. Now the question is, so God, why don't you stop the suffering? So God says, I'll tell you the truth, it's so beautiful. I see the top of the tapestry. For me, this whole challenge that you're going through life, I see it so good. I know you feel the pain and suffering and anguish and terrible, but you see the knots, but I see the top of it. And for me, this suffering is really most accomplished thing that could ever happen. You getting a little what it's happening here? Tell me why.
What do you mean? Suffering is suffering. What do you mean I don't see the suffering? Oh, your blame is words here. No, pain is pain.
Pain is pain?
Yeah, people in the
It's too horrific to be that simple.
Huh?
It's too horrific to be that simple, some of the things that are going in the world. Yeah, I can barely understand what you're trying to explain, or not understand, accept, I guess, you know.
So how do you
what you're trying to say with minor...
Minor suffering, right?
With certain things.
But not big
not
things.
Not with the absolute horrible things.
Like Holocaust and...
No, not even. It doesn't have to be on a large scale.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm talking the absolute horrible things that some people can do to a baby. Just one. I'm not even talking about the large scale of 6 million. Even one.
This is
you know? Mm. It's way too much pain and way too much evil to for me to try and understand.
So I want to ask you and Yosef a question. If God is suffering with us and he feels our pain,
that's his choice.
But why would he want us to suffer?
But that's his choice. He's the one that has a choice.
I understand, but God is so loving and so kind.
Yeah,
why is he suffering? Why does he suffering and want us to suffer with him together? And he feels the pain. Why is he doing that?
We don't see the
bigger picture. Well, your explanation was because he can see the bigger picture, and to him, it's beautiful.
And he sees it beautiful for you. That's the thing.
Because this is the
once again, I understand what you're trying to see. I'm just not accepting it.
Okay, good. I'm also not accepting it. I want to see it beautiful. But Yosef, to answer your question, just one simple thing. Be honest with me. Did you ever have an opportunity to be able to smack your child once at least?
Yes.
Okay. I know. Today you're not allowed to say it. You're going to be in jail and everything. But years ago, like going back 50, 60 years ago, not only the parents smacked the child, the teachers in school used to go one. They used to bang with the ruler on your thumbs. You remember those
in Hebrew school? Yes.
Anyways, no, this is just a second. I'm not saying you did anything. I'm just saying the point. So when you give a smack to the child, right?
Yeah.
So the child feels pain. And the father also feels pain. I mean a normal father, not a father that's just smacking because he frustrated. I'm saying a father that wants to train his child. He feels pain that his child, but he knows that this is a beautiful outcome going to come from this, because now this child will be a mensch. You know what I'm trying to say? So I'm saying to you is, I agree that the suffering is terrible pain. That's not what I'm saying. We're not saying the suffering is not painful. Not at all. And God feels that pain while the pain is going on. He feels that same exact pain, even worse. But God sees a picture that is for us that we don't see it. Yet. But really, this is the most, how would I say, the best thing that could happen to you.
I think that it's easier to grasp this if you go by some belief that we come to life over and over again.
You mean like reincarnation?
Yes.
So you're doing it for the past life?
That's
what you're saying, like you're suffering for the past life?
Not necessarily suffering, but you
can I say something?
You go through the changes. You can grow from things, or the duality of good and bad. That without the bad, you wouldn't know about the good. That's another explanation that people sometimes bring. You know, how would you know what good is if you didn't know what bad is?
I would like good the whole time. You know, even if I don't know how good it is. Okay, what do you say, yeah?
Over the centuries, God did give us something. He gave us an intellect. And over the centuries, we don't have bubonic plague anymore. We don't have polio anymore. We don't have many of the diseases that decimated populations anymore.
We have other diseases.
Polio is still...
We have other diseases, right, that are also being addressed. And many of them with success. And I feel that what God gave us was an intellect and an ability to learn and to study and to eliminate many of these horrific things. That's my opinion.
Yeah, Bobby?
The only way I could like somehow understand it is just seeing the people who have gone through like terrible, terrible things, and the ones that come out and they're so much stronger, mm-hmm. and they give so much to others, that I don't know if the point of life here is that we have to just learn and grow. So that's really what the whole point is, and in a crazy way, that's what it did for those people.
But
at the same time, it's horrible.
What about the ones that didn't make it?
Right. Okay.
Okay. Wait. One second. So, Yosef and what's it? Avi. The next point here is going to conclude, so we'll understand what the whole thing is about. Okay. So now you're suffering. It's a great thing, but what are we supposed to do when we're suffering? What are we supposed to do about it?
Take a Paxil.
Not really. When you're suffering, personal, what are you supposed to do about it? So here is a very interesting thing that people misinterpret a statement in Tehillim, which is in 12a, text 12a. It's a very short statement. It's only like two lines. Well, look what people misinterpret. They say, my God, why have you forsaken me? What means, how are you forsaken me? Why are you leaving me alone and making me suffer? You are far from my salvation and my outcry, right? That's the normal Hebrew, because in Hebrew it's lama, lama. What does lama mean?
Why?
However, that's if you say lama mila'el. But if you say lama mila'ra, you know what the difference between mila'el and mila'ra is? What's the difference? In English, how do you say mila'el and how do you say mila'ra?
Mila'el is when it's heavy on the first syllable. Mila'ra is on the heavy sound of the second syllable, on the last syllable.
You could say lama or lama. What's the difference between lama and lama?
Why or for what?
Lema.
And
not for what purpose? Mm-hmm.
That's the point. Exactly. Look at 12b. Say 12b.
Instead of reading the word lama, meaning for what reason, read the word as lama, meaning for what purpose.
When we're suffering, the question you have to ask is one question. Not why am I suffering, but for what purpose am I suffering? Why you have to ask that question? Because now you have to do something about this suffering that will now recreate, and you'll be, it's called a partner in creation. As we'll see in text 13, what's the mission, why we're here on this world to begin with? You know, people have this notion that I'm here in this world till 120 years for vacation. No, I'm serious about this.
That's not a bad idea.
God sends me here for 120 years in this world. We're alive. For vacation. What a vacation. So I could eat what I want. I could, go a little skiing when I want. You know, just life. Go work, make a living, go do the marathon, 26 miles. You know, I do all the things that I'm supposed to do. But that's not your purpose. God says, I have a mission for you. And when I give you a challenge, I want you not to ask why, I want you to ask for what. For what? The right words I'll use.
Lima.
What is lima? What is the point? And the more you're going to ask yourself that question of what is the point of my suffering, all of a sudden you're going to come out with a creative concept. That because of the suffering, you got to a whole different level.
It changes you.
of whatever you came out with, that you wouldn't have ever got to that at all.
So it's instead of being a victim that you do something that you do something positive.
Exactly. Never in the Torah don't say lama, but say lama. Lama is instead of saying why I'm being a victim, exactly, those are the right words. Instead of being the victim, be the creative and say, okay, so why am I? As it says in text 13, beautiful, this is Rabbi Soloveitchik puts it, yeah.
According to Judaism, man's mission in this world is to turn fate into destiny, an existence that is passive and influenced into an existence that is active and influential, an existence of compulsion, perplexity, and speechlessness into an existence full of will, vision, and initiative. Destiny bestows on man a new status in God's world. It bestows upon man a royal crown, and thus he becomes God's partner in the work of creation. The question of questions is, what does suffering obligate man to do? This problem was important to Judaism when placed it at the center of its Weltanschauung. We do not wonder about the ineffable ways of the Holy One, but instead ponder the paths man must take when evil leaps up at him. We ask not about the reason for evil and its purpose, but rather about its rectification and uplifting. How should a man react in a time of distress? What should a person do so as not to rot in his affliction?
So let's talk for a minute before we finish the last text. Let's take the Holocaust for a second, just for a minute, because you so mentioned here the Holocaust. The Holocaust, no one could say to you, I understand why the Holocaust came. You're stupid. You're meshuggah if you understand it, because no one understands. One thing we do know, that it was the tremendous suffering, right, a disaster, and God was with us in the suffering.
But Israel will never be...
One second. Now you have to ask yourself, if someone is in the Holocaust, says, okay, I'm not going to go figure out now why God brought the suffering. That's not my job now. Because that I'll never know. Because God is with me. He's suffering with me. He feels my pain. That's God's, I don't understand. I will never understand. But one thing I do know, that I have to ponder, so what should I do now? What do I do now with this suffering? Do I just sit and say, okay, it's over? Or do I do something and ponder getting out and being a whole creative and come out with a whole, like you say, Israel, but I don't know if that's an answer, but something, whatever came out of it. Some people say Israel came out of the Holocaust, but it's not, yeah, but I don't give it, how do you say, I don't still don't accept the 6 million for Israel, you know what I'm saying? But the point is that we have to ponder on any time a person goes through a tragedy, not why, but lama. What now should I do about this? We're here in this world to be partners of creation. It says every Friday night when we make Kiddush, we say these words, Vayichulu, the first words of Kiddush. Hashem concluded the creation of the heaven and earth. And the Torah tells us that every time Friday night when we say it, we are partners with God. Why? Because our whole week till Shabbos, we're all creating. God brought us to this world not to be observers or to be bystanders. He wants us to be partners in His creation. So when something befalls you, you can't, the Torah's perspective is don't be the victim of it. On the contrary, say, okay, so now that I'm going through this, so what do I do about it? Lima instead of lama. What do I do? Not why did it happen? Because if you're pondering on the why did it happen, then it's a lost case. You have to ponder and what do I do about this that it happened? Let me come out, be creative. Maybe I could come up with something good that'll come out proactive in this thing, and then I'll be creative and I'll be a partner of God's creation. To say that I can understand why I'm suffering, it's not true. There's no such a thing. That's beyond. That's the tapestry that we can't see. But to say, what do I do about the suffering? Yes, that we could. For example, just give an example. Let's say there's a terrorist attack in Israel, which they had, how many missiles, you said? 500? 400 missiles. 500 missiles.
There is ceasefire.
Huh? Ceasefire, so they could get more missiles. But the point here is, now that I see 500 missiles flying, I guess I could be the victim, or I could say, okay, let me go help these people. Let me help them rebuild their homes. Let me help. Let's make something that we could get those missiles out, never to come. You have to be creative. I don't know what it is, but you can't just say, okay, we're just victims. We're going to have missiles flying. And every 2 months, you'll have another 500 missiles, and hopefully they'll miss. You can't live a life like that. You have to be proactive. Okay, so what do I do to get these missiles out of here? That they shouldn't ever come, not one missile should ever hit here again. What do? I don't just sit and say, okay, let it rain. And then we go over 3 days of rain like this, and then we have a ceasefire for 2 months, and again, 3 days of rain. Yeah.
Okay. So that explains, that's going back to what she mentioned, and then I asked, what about the one that didn't make it? So that explains the choices that the ones that made it have. Me and you are alive, and we have a choice how we want to handle
the stuff
that happens to us. So 500 missile dropped, and a lot of people in Israel have a choice of how they want to handle that situation. The soldier that died doesn't.
So you're asking the people that
different subject, or is that
no, you're asking the people that died in the Holocaust.
No,
in every situation.
So me and you get to talk about the choice that we have because we're here. So me and you now have a choice as far as how we want to handle a situation that happened. What about the ones that died?
So let's do text 14. This is the guy that we spoke about, Jerry J. Litvin, that did die. After 4 years of suffering of the illness, text 14, look what happens.
A colleague wrote me about her grief and sorrow at the loss of a friend who was killed. At the end of my letter, I wrote a strange line to my friend. I was surprised when I read the words as I typed them. May God comfort you when the time is right for comfort, I said. And until then, may the grief enter into the core of your heart and in its breaking bring you closer to God. When I reread this line, I knew I was speaking to myself, writing words to another that were intended for me to hear. What if my heart would break time and time again, each time revealing a new depth of feeling and connection, causing a new sensitivity, a new vulnerability and penetrability, a new sense of faith and source of strength, the strength that comes from knowing that I can feel the fullness of my love and sorrow and still survive, that I can not only survive, but grow to be a source of comfort as well, and a testament to those we have lost. I cannot undo the acts of God. I cannot undo the horror and loss of life, but I can respond to it with my most human and godly self. I can open my heart to the pain and loss. I can allow my heart to break with the knowledge that it will heal and grow larger, and in so doing, I can come closer to the soul that binds us one to the other, closer to God and to the Jewish people.
Listen, I agree that people died in the Holocaust. That's not what I was saying. But if we believe that we're all here in this world for a mission, okay, let's just go back to that text, I think it was 13, that we're all here for a mission, and we have to ask ourselves, Lama. So let's take the people that were killed in the Holocaust. So the fact that they were killed, their mission was over, so to say. It's not like there's nothing more that they could do. For some reason, God took them. God could have taken them other ways. He took them this way. For why, we don't know. So why they had to die, I have no idea. Their mission was finished for that moment. But whoever was in the Holocaust and did come through and survive, so they have to say, so what do I do now? What am I going to do about this suffering? That's our response to always when suffering. And the truth is, the Rebbe's were so strong in this thing, because the Rebbe himself lost his brother, his sister-in-law, his father, his wife's sister-in-law, brother-in-law, You know, everyone who didn't lose people, and the Rebbe had to run away from. He was in France, so he had to run to Marseille and Vichy till he got here in 1941. But the world then in 1945 was like ashes. Disaster. You say, okay, we're over. And the Rebbe felt, no, we have to take this and rebuild this whole life somehow in a different way. In a creative way that the suffering should bring out something totally different. So, thank God we're living in a country, America, Israel today, that's good to the Jewish people, that never existed, till now. But the point here is that in our personal life, let's take, we all had tragedies in our lives, different kinds. One can be an illness, sick child, divorce, someone gets killed, all kinds of things in life. The question is why? Why we don't see the other side of the tapestry? But the question is, what do I do? What could I be creative? What could I be a partner? What could I take this challenge and become? That's our challenge. And that we have the choice. The choice of why it happened, we don't have a choice. But the choice of what to do with what happened, that we do have the choice. I cannot control the fires in California. I really can't. Even the fire people can't. They say they can't. It's like they say the way they use it is like a bird drinking from the ocean. You put water on a fire like this, it's like a bird trying to empty the ocean. That's what they say the disaster is. It's a humongous disaster. Why? We can never understand why. But what do I do about it? Okay, let's go help. Let's create all these people that lost their houses. We got to do something. You know what I mean? Or, you understand a little what I'm saying, yeah?
Yes.
Let's just read the key points and then we'll go to the questions. We'll conclude, yeah? We'll go in a minute. 1 second. Page 124.
We shouldn't confuse our tragedy for God's disinterest in our well-being. He is with us in our hardest times and shares in our pain. We are never alone. 2, responding to tragedy with confusion and outrage is religiously legitimate and even sanctioned. It is unreasonable and impossible for humans to defend the mysterious ways of God since we are incapable of understanding his ways. 3, God has endowed humanity with creative capacities. He wants us to partner with him in creating the story of life. We are not the victims of fate, we are the authors of destiny. 4, although we can't control our circumstances, we can control our responses to them. With enough hope and courage, we can respond to tragedy with personal growth. This is the ultimate challenge.
Okay, yeah, what do you want to ask?
I was just going to say that my mother was one of 11 children, and 9 of them died in the Holocaust, and she and her brother survived. And she would always tell me, she couldn't understand why God picked her to survive, because she felt like a lot of her brothers and sisters were better people than she was, and she couldn't. She felt guilty that she survived and some, and that they didn't. But I guess what you're saying is
we don't know why. We just know. We just
turned it around.
Yeah, not be the victim, but do something. Yeah.
Said, okay, what can I do? But she had a good life, so.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Sabrina, what's your question?
Yes, my question is, how does this reconcile with, I think it was a different class, but we were talking about how God, we can't imagine that God actually has feelings or pain or, the way that we do. But here we keep talking about how he feels our pain, the same pain along with us.
And you're saying if God doesn't have any feelings, how could he
God
feel our pain?
God is not human. He doesn't have the same attributes and way of experiencing things that we do.
He's not human.
Yeah. Right. So the answer is you're right. God does not have feelings at all. But God could choose to have the feelings. Meaning, it's not like God, like we suffer. God chooses that he wants to suffer with us. He tells us, I am choosing to be with you in your pain. And the Torah says it, I am with you in your pain.
So this is kind of along the lines of I can be infinite.
And he can make himself finite.
You know, it's very interesting because people that did survive the Holocaust, and there were fortunately, you know, quite a few, they did live their lives with guilt. I mean,
guilt.
A lot of guilt. Yeah, they did.
I had someone that was depressed for 6 months this year. That I tried to call him so many times, never answered me. And I went today to his wife, who was sitting shiva for her mother. And I thought to talk to him, what made you so depressed? Like, why are you so, what happened? I mean, your children are married, one child is having twin girls soon, the other child, like, what happened to you? He says, I'll tell you. A year and a half ago, his father passed away. And after his father passed away, he felt so guilty that he caused his father to pass away.
Oh my.
I said, why do you feel so guilty? He said, I'll tell you. I took my father on vacation with the whole family. We went like on a cruise, whatever. And he had a great time. And everything was great. And then the last day, he wasn't feeling so good. You know, he felt a little weak. So when we came back, my wife said, okay, I'll take him to the doctor. And she took him to the doctor, and he had some infection, whatever, went to the hospital. And meanwhile, he went to work. And then, during work, his wife calls him, oh, your father just passed away. He said, what? What happened? So he felt guilty that maybe, if he wouldn't have taken his father on the vacation for the week. So his father, I'm just telling you what happened. I just want to share, because I heard it today. I said, wow. So his father would have been here, not on the cruise. And then if he would have felt not so good, he would have been in the hospital earlier. And if he would have been in the hospital earlier, so maybe he would have still been alive. And now that I took him on the cruise and I took him on vacation, so I caused him to pass away faster. And therefore he felt so guilty, he ate him up. He just couldn't, and he was depressed. He couldn't see people. He sat in the house, and he couldn't go to work. And he was like a disaster. So I said to him, I want to ask you a question. Do you believe that everything that happens was meant to happen anyway? God wanted it to happen? Do you think that your father wouldn't have died that moment that he was supposed to? I mean, you believe that whenever the time comes, the time comes. And I asked him, was your father ill? He said, of course he was ill. He had six times he had cancer. Oh, he had six times cancer, okay. Did he have any illness before? Yeah, and he goes on all the illnesses. So he says, so you have to look at it the other way. Thank God you had a week to spend before he passed and he was 92 years old. So, of course, it happened. But thank God you had a week with the whole family that he was able to celebrate 1 week before you passed. Not because he would have passed away anyway because he had all the illnesses that he was got. But he was, thank God he's getting out of it. But I'm just saying, this is called a victim.
It's so unfair
that he. You know what I'm saying? He failed, but that's what he felt. He couldn't speak to anyone. It's like, he was like this, like numb. Yeah?
I know at least three or four men, women who also felt that kind of guilt. And these survivors too. Like I was a child of survivors of the camps. And the guilt that we used to feel sometimes, I've got through that when the parents passed away. Oh, but they made it through camps, the concentration camps, they made it. And they were 85, 86, and they all started feeling guilty about it. I once went, when I was younger, went to a therapy, a group therapy with survivors' children. So I had a couple of, one man and one woman who were guilty that they were alive.
Yeah.
They were in pain because they were alive. Because look what my mother went through, and here I am, and I'm born, and things are not going well for me, and my parents suffered for me to be born. I mean, this Mishigasa, they go through, now it's not, I'm not making light of it. They suffered. But it was an amazing thing to see, how people really blame themselves. So much of what's going on. Anyway.
Does anyone want to share an experience, if you don't mind, of something you went through, a suffering, if you want to. If you don't want to, you don't have to. And that how you used it in a very positive way, and you... Yes, Tavi, what happened to you?
So I just found it interesting, like the last thing that we read that Jay Lithman wrote. I'm not going to say what happened, but different things. And literally last night I wrote something and it has like exactly what to do. And I was like, oh, that's so cool. So I'll just share like a little bit of it. Basically the point is just like what happens. Like once you're able to see past through it, it's. I just found that just makes me stronger. And that's really what I have to get out of it. And like how I could like, and then pass that forward. So when I was a young child, I was always happy and carefree. Sometimes as I grew older, my happiness would shatter, but I was able to quickly move on and put it back together. Nowadays, sometimes I feel like I'm shattering again and again and again before I can even put anything back together, keep shattering. How can that even be possible? It's different though now because I realize that not necessarily am I shattering, I'm actually stronger inside. My innocence might be lost, but my belief is still there and my hope is still there. And that's what's keeping me going. And not always should we shatter, because Hashem put us there for a reason. And He believes in me to be there for that moment and to help in that moment or to give in that moment. And our challenges are stepping stones for growth, even if we can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. But maybe our job is to actually be that light. And I was writing it to someone. I just wrote, like, I love you, I believe in you, and that it's good, and always be there for you. So, yeah, it's just...
Thank you so much. Okay, and I want to just end up with a blessing.